On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, April 13th, the Deathbed Sandwich Generation Edition. I'm Gabriel Roth, Slate Senior Editor, and I'm here with Carvel Wallace from Oakland, California. Hi, Carvel.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And Rebecca Lavoie from the wilds of New Hampshire. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Gabe. How you doing?
Good. This week, we're going to talk about being a parent while your own parents are approaching the end of their lives. We're also going to do triumphs and fails and recommendations. First, a couple of announcements in Slate Plus. Slate editor John Swansburg is going to come in with a parenting fail slash conundrum involving Sesame Street. And if you're not already a Slate Plus member, then you should sign up for Slate Plus. You can do it through slate.com/momanddadplus, or you can get 3 free months of Slate Plus by using Slate's iOS app. Just download the Slate app in the App Store or go to slate.com/app, and you'll get 3 free months, 90 days of Slate Plus, including this bonus segment of today's podcast, absolutely free. If you're not already on our Facebook page, you should be on our Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. If you have any questions that you'd like us to address on the show, call and leave us a message at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-7833. Okay, that's it for announcements. Let's talk about our triumphs and our fails. Rebecca, have you triumphed or failed recently?
Failed big time.
I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, in a way, I'm glad for entertainment purposes. What failure have you committed recently?
Well, I'm really looking for advice as to whether or not this was my failure or my husband's failure. He knows I'm talking to you about this, so full disclosure, but he totally sucks. And this is how he sucks. He is a very, very laid back guy, which is one of the reasons why I adore him. He's easygoing. He's very, you know, amenable to things. He's game to try stuff. You know, he's just, but his default setting is the static position. Like, his default setting is not the like proactive go position. So that's a little bit of context. On Sunday, I had to leave for the whole day with my older son to go do something very important. You know, I left in the morning, and, you know, one of the things about living with and loving a laid back person is that part of the deal is that you really need to be very clear and sort of lay out, you know, if you need stuff done or taken care of, like, you need to be really specific about it. So I left, and I was like, there are two things that I'm really looking for when I get back. One of them is the laundry having been advanced to a degree that looks like the project has advanced several stages. And the other thing is that Teddy, my younger son, really needs to get his homework done. I'm very uncomfortable sending him back to his dad's house unless for sure he's gotten all of his homework done, and that may involve him going up the street to his teenage life coach or just doing it. I don't care how it happens. It just needs to happen. So, you know, fast forward 8.5 hours, you can probably guess where this is going. When I return home at, you know, 5:30 at night after leaving at 9 o'clock in the morning, neither one of those things has been accomplished at all, like just at all. And, you know, the sort of reasoning is very much like, oh, well, Teddy says Sam isn't home, and, you know, so he was going to get back to him. I'm not really sure what's going on with that. And the laundry, you know, that washer sometimes flashes that code thing that happens. And, you know, so it just took forever to spin. And, you know, so I just, you know, this is the fail part, the real fail part, is that then I go into like full on enraged sort of like naggy mom mode where I'm like now parenting everyone. And I'm like, if I'm not here, nothing happens. You know, I need to be able to leave the house and just know these basic things are going to happen. And I turn into a giant shrew. So the fail, I think, is systemic. I, you know, somehow haven't yet figured out how to be able to leave the house all day and either have things, you know, happen the way that maybe they should in a cooperative family environment, and or not end up turning into a giant mom shrew when I get home and, for the most part, am generally disappointed because usually nothing has happened in the period of time I've been out of the house. So that was my fail of the week. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on it. You're both guys. You both are husbands or ex-husbands, and you're both dads. And have you ever been in this position? And should I keep this fail all to myself, or should I share some of it with my wonderful husband, Kevin, who also sucks?
Carvel, I assume you have totally solved this problem over the course of your life, and I look forward to hearing your solution.
This is elementary. No, I mean, well, first of all, let me just say, I'm really sorry that you had that experience. That is really difficult. That's a difficult thing to feel like, because what I'm hearing in that is a sense of overwhelm. Like you mentioned that you were gone on a weekend day from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. So what I hear in that is a sense of like, I've extended myself in this extra way. And all I'm asking in return is that these other things for which I am somehow default responsible get taken care of in my absence, right? In other words, too many things are falling on me and it's not fair. And I just want to start by saying I'm really sorry that you had that experience, because that is difficult.
Aww,
and being a
thanks.
Parent, and yeah, and yeah, I mean, because being a parent is overwhelming and being a partner is overwhelming. And there is invariably, we run up against that feeling that there's just too much to do and we can't get it all done. And that feeling of frustration probably hides some level of fear. I don't, you can talk about that with your therapist, but in my experience, there's always a fear underneath that, that I'm not a good parent, I'm not a good husband, I'm not a good dad, I'm not getting things done. And so that's kind of why it becomes much bigger than just the laundry or just the homework. So that having been said, my feeling is that you should be able to say, I asked for these things to happen. These things didn't happen. I feel upset about that. And I think communicating that is really important, because communication is a super important part of co-parenting, marriage, and running a household together. So that's three different sort of partnership enterprises that you're in with this person. And I think that the ability to state what your feelings are and what your reactions are to what happened you should always have that right. However, one of the things that I always try and teach my kids, and I don't know how well I am at doing this, is that we try to communicate our feelings as opposed to demonstrating them. And so I'm taking it back to first grade here. So we communicate our feelings by saying, hey, I feel upset about the fact that this thing happened. Can we talk about that? What can I hear from your point of view, you know, what your thoughts are about that? As opposed to demonstrating them, which is something I do, where I'm going to make sure you feel my upset. I mean, you're going to hear it in my tone of voice. You're going to know I'm going to like freeze you out. I'm going to answer you with one word answers. Whatever my little shtick is on that day, that's me trying to pass off my feeling onto this person.
We have the same shtick, it turns out.
In a sense, yeah, and yes, in a sense, it's a form of punishment, right? I feel upset, so now I want you to feel some discomfort as well. And when I do that, that's my ultimate goal, is to now basically a vengeance punishment. I want to get them to have bad feelings because I have bad feelings, which is separate from communicating. So my summary is that you should always be allowed to communicate, but for the sanctity of your partnership and family, it's probably best to continue to work on not demonstrating and trying to punish in return for your feeling of being upset.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm there with you. And honestly, that's exactly what happened, as I said. I'm really upset because I was gone all day and I only asked for these two things. And, you know, you can understand why I'm frustrated about that, right? And that really was the conversation. We have a good, for the most part, relationship. I feel the feeling of shrewishness is sort of what I'm trying to control here. And also also creating systems where I can legit leave the house, you know? And I mean, I can. But the bottom line is I am the default of making sure just stuff happens. And even though I don't do all the stuff, I am the default person to make sure that all the stuff actually happens. And
right. That it comes down a lot to like ownership. Like you apparently own laundry in your family, even if you're not the person actually, like your husband was meant to be the person doing the laundry, but you're the person who's like accountable for whether the laundry gets done or not. And so all you can do is like, you can delegate to him, But in the end, he's not accountable. And so when the little warning thing is flashing up on the screen, when the error message is up there, then like, what can he do? All he can do is send it back up the chain to you because you delegated it down to him. He does. Somehow the process has worked out that he doesn't have ownership of the outcome of the laundry. And I think that's what you most need to change is like somebody, you need to own less and he needs to own more. And then you can like trade off the actual tasks, but he needs to be accountable for the outcome. And the same with homework, obviously.
Yeah.
Although given that, I think I'm right in saying this is your son and not his son.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have this, like, would it be possible for him to have ownership over his stepson's homework? Or is that always going to fall to you?
I mean, it's always going to fall to his stepson, ultimately. But that's a whole separate conversation. But, you know, we have, again, an unusual situation insofar as I do feel sometimes like he feels more like he wants to own those things than most stepdads would. But yeah, I think that's really sage what you talked about ownership, because that's what happens at work, right? There are some tasks you own at work that you don't actually do, but ultimately you're the one who has to report on them and make sure they happen and facilitate processes and so forth. So the bottom line, though, is, Gabe, I also want to have clean pants. So,
And maybe he doesn't particularly less of a priority for him.
He's laid back. I think I explained that already, right?
Yeah. So what, I'm curious what his reaction was when you brought this issue to him.
He's like,
was he defensive?
He wasn't defensive. He was like, I know. He's like, I totally duffed this one. You know, I was working on, you know, he was producing one of our podcasts and it was just sort of like rabbit hole. And I figured Teddy's thing was, nothing I could do. And, you know, it's very, like I said, he's like super wonderful and laid back guy. So it's not like he's saying, you put me in an impossible situation. Like, he knows it was like two minor things to do on like a 10-hour period. And, you know, it was a whole thing. It wasn't as much of a thing as I think it would have been in a not as good dynamic relationship. But anyway, I
will say a thing that I do when I'm in his situation that has helped me, that I've started doing over the past 6 months, is like setting reminders on my phone and not letting myself ignore them. Like, if I need to check the laundry in an hour, I make my phone annoy me and say, like, check the laundry. And I can like defer it by 10 minutes or whatever the thing on the phone is. But then it's just going to annoy me again and stop me from doing what I really want to do. So eventually it does motivate me to like do the laundry.
Right.
Suggest that he start like constantly telling Siri to remind him to check the laundry or whatever.
Develop maybe that will some help tools.
Him. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right, Carvel. Got a triumph or a fail?
Today I have a triumph because I had a fail last week. And as I always say, every day is a parenting triumph and fail. But today I'm feeling pretty good because this past weekend, my two kids and our family friend and their kid and another kid friend who we just grabbed along all went to a beach house in sort of north of here in California, this beautiful thing where we split the cost of it for two nights and stayed in this house and looked out over the waves and that sort of thing. And that was something that was so much fun. But I think one of the great moments of it was that, you know, we had a power outage on the first night because there was a pretty severe storm in California on, I think Thursday night was the night we got there. So we lost power for probably 4 hours. And, you know, our kids are 14, 14, 11, and 11 were the kids that were on the trip with us. So if you get that group of kids together in a house, a beach house, all they're going to do is like stare at phones for umpteen hours. And so that power outage was great. It was a miraculous intervention because then we had to play board games and charades, which we did for 5 hours. Even after the lights came on, we were involved in a very competitive and intense charades match. And it was just, I had this realization again that I could take a step back from parenting and just hang out with these people as people, and that I didn't have to intervene or teach them lessons or argue with them about how they're approaching life or how they're behaving. So this is similar to the New York trip that I described a few weeks ago, where I had another level of letting go. And letting go is like a constant theme for me in my parenting triumphs now that my kids are of letting go age. But maybe the best moment of it was they stayed up really late, and at one, there was a hot tub. We, the adults, were hanging out in the hot tub. We come back inside. People go to sleep. The kids come. My son comes downstairs, and I'm looking out at this ocean, and it's super dark and gorgeous and the moonlight and the whole thing. And my son comes downstairs, and he's looking for his phone, obviously. And he is feeling upset about something, and I can sense it. So I ask him what's going on. And then he starts to unload all this stuff that's happening in his life. Fear about what he's going to do with his future. Fear about, does he feel like he belongs? Does he have friends? Is he cool? What's he going to do? And we were able to kind of sit there and, you know, in like parallel gaze, both of us looking out this window, looking at the ocean. And I was able to, I had this thought like, oh my God, this is the talk. I got to make sure not to screw this up. You know, like, this is my opportunity to have this like storied bonding moment with my kid. I got to make sure not to screw this up. And what I focused most on in that conversation was trying to listen more than I talked. I don't know if I achieved that, but that's what I was hoping. And also not trying to solve every problem for him in that moment. Just to be able to say, yeah, that sounds difficult. Yeah, that's you know, I understand why it feels that way. You know, I feel like you're going to be okay, but I know it doesn't feel that way to you. And that was basically my main message. And after that talk, I noticed a tremendous shift in our relationship. And I feel like listening was the key. It was the key that kind of unlocked the door to like a new level of respect between us. So I would say that with the assistance of Mother Nature cutting out the lights, that was a parenting triumph for me.
Wow.
That's a heck of a triumph.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all going to go downhill again soon because his grades are coming out. And so I'm just, you know, they just ended the quarter and I know it's not going to be happy. So I'm able to enjoy that. And
but now you have context, sort of, right? Because his life, you, if you start seeing him as more of a full person, you know, the only product he's responsible for producing right now is these grades, as far as you're concerned, like parentally, right? Like the kids can kind of, you know, he can have his own style, wear what he wants, you know, use whatever language he wants, as long as those grades are good, right? That's sort of usually our focus. But with more
Generally,
context, and you sort of step back and see them as a fuller person, maybe some of that grade stuff plays into some of those other conversations you've been having, right?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I've mentioned this before, but his grades are a tremendous mystery to both of us. I think more to me, I think his mother has more quickly accepted that he's just not getting good grades and that's just one of his things. And I still am like wrestling with the notion that there's something I can do to change this for him. And I'm aware sort of intellectually that that's really beating my head against a brick wall. And yet I'm still trying because there may be a crack in there somewhere. So, yeah, you're right. Like part of the serenity for me, which allows me to be a better parent, is the slow, painful, and sometimes frightening process of accepting reality, accepting reality, accepting reality. And like you said, having more context for him, because when I take the grades out of it, I'm like, this kid is great.
Yeah.
What a great guy.
That's how I feel about my son, Teddy, as well. He's terrible with the grades and he's brilliant. And it's, you take that out of the equation and your whole experience with him is wonderful.
I have a small parenting triumph. It probably glorifies it to call it a triumph, but I solved a problem that had been bugging me for a while, which is to do with my own mom who lives in London, England. And so we don't get to see her as much as any of us would like. And she doesn't get to see the kids as much as she would like. And we talk to her on the weekends. We do FaceTime and the kids can FaceTime with her and she loves it and they love it. And for them, that's like almost as good as watching Peppa Pig. You know what I mean? It's like grandma is like a little bit more screen time to them. So they love that. But I never really get to like talk to her. I never get to tell her how anybody's doing or like how the kids are doing or how I'm feeling about stuff or whatever. Because, you know, the time difference and she's talking to the kids on FaceTime and everybody's running around and everything like that. And this had been kind of bugging me that like I sort of don't get to talk to my mom. I started writing her short emails like once a week about what the kids are doing and what I'm doing, like two paragraphs. And now we have like a written correspondence of a kind that I don't remember having since like, I don't know, 10 years or 15 years when before there were computers and people would, or before there was like Facebook and when people would write letters. And it turns out to be a great way to stay in touch with my mom in England. So that has been my minor triumph or solution.
That's a big deal. That's not wonderful. Nothing.
No, it feels good.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, I think you're downplaying that. I mean, to be able to stay in touch, to figure out a way to stay in touch with our parents, especially as they advance in age, it's really important. And it's hard. It's much harder than we give it credit for, I think.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to want to, you know, because I think with our parents, we get locked in these conversational traps where, you know, with me and my mom, like every conversation starts with a long soliloquy about how upset she is that we haven't talked in so long, which is completely disincentivizing to like have the next conversation. And even though I've explained that many, many times, you know, I just have now learned that that is the way we start our conversations is by me apologizing for not being in better touch. And so to have that desire to learn to feel and to, you know, really accept the fact that you feel like you want to be connected, I think that's really great. I mean, that's something that I would like to, you know, make more a part of my life, you know, especially now, as I'm sure we'll talk about shortly. But I think that's really, really wonderful and inspiring.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
Rebecca, I know you have been dealing with some issues with your stepfather, I think.
Yep. So my stepfather, George, has been in my life really since I was about 6 years old. So he's not, you know, a recent addition. He is a lot older than my mom, about 13 years older, and he's 87. And in the last few years, he's had a lot of health problems. And I'd say I feel like, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've maybe had 6 or 7 times where we thought, oh, George is, he's not going to be around for too much longer. So we've had like 5 last Christmases with George, which has been, you know, every year it's like, oh, I thought that last time was going to be the last one, which is, you know, it is what it is. Now he really is at the end. He went to the hospital for something, you know, few weeks ago, I want to say 6 weeks ago, 5-6 weeks ago, and he's never gone home, and he's not going to. It's pretty clear, and he's dying. I mean, this is what it looks like, and it's every time they live about a little over 2 hours away. Every time I go over there, it's definitely he's a lot worse. I always think it's going to be the last time. It's sort of like a microcosm of the last 5 years, where every time I go over, I'm like, this is the last time I'm going to come over here and see him, and then the next week, I'm like, this is the last time. So it's definitely a protracted, long and difficult process, and dealing with that with the kids has just presented some really surprising and sometimes kind of distasteful in terms of talking about them challenges. But as I have talked about them, I've come to realize that I'm not the only person to ever, you know, grapple with this kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
as you've talked about it with other people who have lost parents?
Yeah, you know? And well, who've dealt also with this kind of losing a parent, where it is, you know, this protracted, long, sort of expected thing. I mean, I'll give you an example. So, you know, communicating, going over there with the kids, it's like we're at the point now where if every single time I got a text or phone call from my mom or email that George is in a really bad way, this is an emergency, if I went over there every time, I would be going over there every single day. And at the same time, you know, the boys have like a lot going on. You know, my stepdaughter, too, like she's got like prom this weekend and like, you know, there's a concert that my son is in one day and there's obviously work stuff that I'm coping with. So it's become this like balance where, yes, it's also, you know, helping my mom, supporting her. She's dealing with a lot of logistics, but it has really become like a logistical juggling and conversation. Like we are no longer doing the it's so sad that George is dying part of the process. It's more like, you know, let's look at the calendar and figure out when we can get over there, who should go. You know, I didn't go. I went with Henry on Sunday and not Teddy because Teddy had a lot of homework to do, which, as you know now, it did not get done. we're having all of these weird conversations around. And meanwhile, somebody's dying. Like, this is what it's framed around. And so, you know, my worries are my kids seeing me not being like a super devoted child to a parent? You know, are my kids, do they benefit by seeing George now when he's not really recognizing them anymore and he's only able to talk for like a minute or two at a time? Is it a benefit to him or to them, you know, to drive over there and have like one of these visits with him that's very, very difficult and depressing? And, you know, and it's just as a lot of that kind of stuff. And I don't know, it's just brought out a lot of stuff. I mean, that's all I can say about it.
Well, first of all, my condolences. I'm really sorry.
Well, thank you.
It's a really hard situation. How long has he been in hospital?
This time it's been about 2 months, actually. I realize now it's been 60-something days, only because I had a logistical conversation with my mom about Medicare the other day, so that's the only reason I know the number. So it's been over 60 days that he's been in the hospital, and now he's in a facility that's like at the hospital, sort of like a care facility. Yes, yeah, so it's been
like
a couple of months.
A hospice?
No, it's like it's similar. It's like a rehab center, but, you know, he can just stay there. It's like a hospice, but it's not in particular, it's not a hospice, so...
And what's your sense of how much longer he has to live?
Funny you should ask, because 6 weeks ago, I thought it was a couple days. Today, I think it's a day or two. That's the way it is all the time. There's no sense that it's going to be longer than a day or two every single day. And now it's been a couple of months that we've been having the same conversation. We've made funeral plans. You know, we've doled out tasks for people to do. You know, when he dies, it's like the part of it that you usually try to cram into a few days afterwards. Like, we've actually already done all that stuff, which is also weird. And it's a strange kind of thing. But it's brought out a lot of, you know, family dynamic stuff. As you know, we were driving back from Vermont on Sunday. We were listening to, my son is learning to drive, so he's driving, and it was a good opportunity for him to get a lot of driving hours in, which is, I'm like, how horrible is that I was thinking that way? But that's kind of how logistical this has become. And we were listening to This American Life, and there was an episode on about, you know, a conversation that a parent was having with an adult child they couldn't have when they were kids. And, you know, we're just talking about it like it's an episode of This American Life. And I realized, like we should really be talking about this for real, because we just came from a parent who's dying. And is this opening up like an opportunity for us to really talk? But it's just like if we did that every day that we thought George was dying, it's all we would talk about. So we're not really talking about it at all.
Did you talk about it when it first began to seem like he was dying?
Yes, we did. And here's the rub. It's like, how much of my kids' lives should be about this inevitability hanging over them? You know, should they be able to kind of go on, go to school, do the things they were looking forward to doing, you know, see their friends, do their homework, participate in school musicals, all that stuff? Should they be able to continue doing all that stuff even though Grandpa George is dying in the background? I mean, that's the way that I feel, I've set it up that way so that they can. And, you know, I'm, you know, talking to my mom pretty regularly and that's sort of hanging over me. But, you know, it's, they're also seeing me go to work every day and continuing to do the stuff that I usually do. And yeah, I mean, that's that. And I know this is not unusual. I know that like long term, you know, declines, it's something that happens. It's just, it's rough. I really do think it's a rough way to lose a parent because it doesn't seem intuitive. Like all the feelings you thought you would have, you have them. And then you're dealing with all other stuff and then you feel weird about not having the feelings you think you're supposed to have. And then you worry about what your kids are seeing. You know, I don't know if either one of you has any experience with this at all.
Yeah, I do actually have experience with this. My mom died of lung cancer in 2008 and I was an only child. So I was the guy in that scenario. And at that point, my kid's mom and I were still married. The kids were, 2008, so they would have been 5 and 3. And we kind of had everyone, including my mom, all sort of jammed into our two-bedroom in L.A. It was, yeah, what you described, particularly about being surprised by you have all the feelings you think you're going to have, but then you have all these other feelings that you weren't expecting. I think that's the case for everyone. And like what I was going to ask you a little bit about how your kids are responding to this and what they're saying. But before I get to that, I just want to give you permission to think logistically about a logistical matter, despite the feeling that you should be in this constant state of, I don't know what the expectation is for you, that you should be in a constant state of mourning or a constant state of like, sort of like spiritual and emotional presence with this scenario. None of that is true. Like the loss of a parent is weird. Death is weird. It strikes you in all kinds of weird ways at weird times. And I think that you kind of, in order not to make it worse for yourself, you kind of have to just be down with that. Like today I'm feeling like I sort of hope this is over because it's such a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And that's a terrible feeling, but it's true. And now today I hope this person never dies because I don't want this, you know, I don't want to lose them. And now today all I can think about is like, some money situation or some logistical or how I'm going to handle this like upcoming conference.
A vacation situation. That's what we're faced with.
Exactly.
We've got a vacation planned in 2 weeks. And so last week I had like the weird conversation with myself where I'm like, if George dies tomorrow, like we'll be in the clear, or he has to hang on until the first week in May. Like,
right, but if he dies next week, then you're not in the
clear. Crazy.
No, absolutely.
Right?
And that's, It is. But I also just want to put a plug in for like, it's crazy for all of us. You're not doing anything wrong by just experiencing the craziness of it. Like I found that when my mom died, I was most surprised by the way, like there was a lot I was surprised by, but I found that I was most surprised that the slate of feelings I experienced was not what I thought I was going to. But then I was like, why would I know what I've experienced? I've never had this before. So whatever I'm experiencing apparently is it, you know? And so there's a level of acceptance that has to go on. You're okay. Like, it's okay that you're thinking logistically about what to do with your vacation. If he dies tomorrow, you can go. If he dies in a week, you can't. That's fine. That doesn't make you a monster or ghoulish or a person who lacks human empathy. But I do want to ask what your kids are saying, because you brought up this other interesting question about how do I integrate or not integrate my children in this lengthy process. What are they saying about it?
Well, they've been really great about, you know, a couple of times I'm like, hey, do you want to go over and see? And they're like, yeah, I really want to. So they've been really great about wanting, like they understand that it's important to be there for your family. And I'm really trying to figure out whether or not they're going to keep me company or they're going to actually see George. Because like I said, the actual visits with George are unsubstantial and incredibly difficult and depressing and short. They're like very, very short. I mean, you can call George on the phone. You can talk for like 5 seconds and, you know, then he's falls back asleep or whatever. So they've been great. And I feel like they were so great when George was still kind of with us, you know, a few weeks ago when he was able to sit up and really visit, that I feel like they've put in their time in a way. And, you know, they've demonstrated they care. You know, they've demonstrated they're thinking about this. They text me and ask me about it when they're at their dad's. And I kind of feel like, you know, you you've done your part. Like, I know you're going to be there for grandma after George dies. I know you're going to want to go to the funeral and you're going to want to do all this stuff. And, you know, so I think it's okay. And I think they're okay. You know, like I said, it was a good opportunity for my son to get some driving in. So I think that sort of played into his willingness to come over there with me on Sunday. But it was also a nice way for us to spend some time together. They've been great. They've been great. They think it's very sad. They always, you know, spent a week with my parents during the summer at their house in Vermont. But, you know, their relationship with my parents is very tongue-in-cheek funny, like, who takes little kids to go antiquing? Grandma and grandpa do, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So it's kind of wrapped up in that also.
It seems to me that it just like Carvel said, he wanted to give you permission to feel the strange mix of things that you're feeling. You want to make sure to give your kids permission to feel whatever weird mix of things that they wind up feeling.
Right.
And that will include being sad about losing Grandpa George. And it will also include being really excited about going on vacation or about something at school or whatever it is. And yeah, if this process has been 2 months already and it might be another week or month or however long, then life goes on. Even in the midst of tragedy, life goes on. And that's something that they're going to learn from this just as you're going to learn it.
It does, yeah. And I will tell you, the vacation conversation actually like bore some logistical fruit, which I finally, when I went to see my parents on Sunday, said to my mom, like, there's this elephant in the room that I just want to like run by you. We have a vacation plan at the end of April. And I'm, you know, really just a little bit worried about it because it's kind of part of like the landscape of our year. And, you know, obviously if I can't go or we can't go, like we'll figure that out. But I just want to let you know this is something that I'm thinking about. You know, I'm kind of worrying about it in the back of my head. And she said, oh, I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, I'm actually talking to the minister and we're picking out some potential Saturdays in May, perhaps, if George dies before then, we can have the memorial service. So I'll just make sure, because we're doing cremation, so it can be whenever. And I'll just make sure that, you know, these days, it won't be one of these two Saturdays. And I'm like, I can't believe that I said this incredibly sensitive thing, but it actually... It really seemed to help, you know, because my mom was sort of she was unwilling or unable to sort of make those kinds of decisions and think about that. But like my bringing up this vacation kind of made her commit to making some decisions in a weird way. So it's messed up. I mean, to talk to your mom who's losing her husband and say, I'm in the background worried about my vacation, you do feel a little bit like a monster. But it also turned out being helpful. So I guess the moral lesson that we can take from it is there's no right. Is that what you guys are saying? There's no right way. I shouldn't feel uncomfortable saying this in front of thousands of people on a podcast. I'm not going to get, you know, fruit thrown at me on the street or something.
I certainly don't think you deserve to have fruit thrown at you in the street.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think there are wrong ways to deal with the death of a parent, but nothing you're describing to me sounds like it's the wrong way, right? I think you're just kind of coming to grips with the surprise things that you didn't expect, you know. But they're true, and the logistical things are true. And my experience too is that sometimes those logistical things can be helpful because they give us something to do with our hands, basically our grief. With our grief, right? Our grief hands,
right.
Or whatever.
Idle hands.
Like people, idle hands. There is a need to sort out the details of, and I think, you know, there's obviously death has so many layers of acceptance and denial and grief and whatever. And I found in my own experience with my mother that walking through that grief, that having to handle logistical things was helpful because it gave me something to do. And it also helped me transition into acceptance about the reality of this thing. You know, once you begin to be like, well, we're going to have to plan the ceremony and these are some logistical concerns about when and where we can do it. It helped me accept the deeper reality that I think I was struggling with, which is that this is going to happen. And I found that to be something of a relief. And I was really also grateful when other people came to me to help with logistics, that because then I didn't feel like I was in it alone, you know. So nothing you've described sounds like you're way out of line, and it sounds like your kids are doing a great job. I mean, you are modeling for your kids how to deal with death. It sounds like you are doing that.
Oh, and thanks.
Again, it's not this. It's that. I mean, they seem to get it. Your kids sound intelligent. They're older. They seem to understand that when a parent dies or when an older person dies, it's all these things. It's sad. It's annoying. It's logistical. It's logistically difficult. It's boring. It's uncomfortable. You know, and that's just what you roll with as part of the process of accepting death.
Carvel, what do you remember about being with your kids at the time that your mother was dying or had died?
I remember, and they were, of course, a lot younger, so it's different. But I remember that my daughter seemed to really get the need to just be present with my mom as much, right? She would just go into the room and just hang out with her. You know, she would just kind of crawl in the bed and talk with her and sit with her. And there didn't seem to be, you know, I think my son, who was older, felt more intensity about how do I handle this? There's some grief here. There's some difficulty. My mother was also, God bless her, not an easy person to deal with anyway. And so I think my son experienced some of that. So I think he had very mixed feelings about her sudden presence in our house. Because the other thing is that she didn't live with us, and then all of a sudden she did, and also she was dying. So I think for him that was a lot. I think for my daughter, one thing I really learned is that, and this is something that I learned from my kid's mom's dad died many years ago, back in, I think, 2000. And one of the things that she said was that, you know, a lot of friends didn't call. We were young. We were in our 20s, right? But a lot of friends didn't call. And they didn't email. They didn't send text messages. And one of the things that we learned is that people felt like, well, I didn't know what to say. I just didn't know what to do. And her response was always, you know, all I needed was for you to just be there. You don't have to know what to do. I just need you to be there. And that's something that I saw repeated when my daughter interacted with my mother at the time of her death, is that my daughter was just there. She couldn't help. She couldn't change the bedpan. She couldn't administer the pills or whatever. But she just was present. And after a while, I started to pick up on that and go, oh, that's really what I'm supposed to do here. I don't, even though I'm like ostensibly the head of logistical operations of this person's death, that is not as, doesn't take up as much time as I like to think. Really, my primary purpose here is just to be present. And that can be uncomfortable because we want to have answers, but we don't always have answers. And we definitely don't have answers when it comes to death. We don't, and we never will. And so I think towards the end, I started finally picking up on that my job was just to be present.
Rebecca, have you seen any sort of change in your kids or any way that they've reacted that has surprised you in all this?
I think the thing that's been most surprising to me is that, you know, most of our family conversations in our, you know, little family, not with my parents, about my parents is very much sort of in the vein of like eye rolling, you know, they're so, you know, my parents live like it's the 18th century. That's like a joke that we always make, but they really do. You know, they like iron their sheets. They're very like, they take a very long time to do things, not because they're old, but because like they're just really old fashioned about a lot of things. Like if they need a lampshade, they go to the lampshade store. You know, that's kind of how my parents are. And I've really been amazed by how sort of talking about my parents, my kids have just, the sort of, I don't want to call it cutting, but the sort of like humor, like the vernacular around talking about my parents has really softened. Like they really seem to have tremendous empathy and appreciation, and they're still able to, you know, to be funny and have humor, but sort of understand that, you know, they have the instinct that like, you know, certain parts of the relationship just aren't important. It's not important that, you know, mom and George couldn't get dinner on the table until 10 p.m. because they had to like make the salad dressing from scratch and it had 47 ingredients. That's not important. What's important is that they're our family and that it's really sad that George isn't going to be with us for very much longer. And, you know, and it's really sad for grandma. So I've been really impressed with their being able to read the room and respond emotionally appropriately. It's been really wonderful.
Mm. Well, thanks for talking with us about this.
Thanks for letting me, guys. It's really tough, but this has been really nice, actually. Thanks.
All right. Let's move on to recommendations. Carvel, do you have anything to recommend?
I do have a recommendation. I mentioned it before, but I recommend the game Charades. There's something so that works so well for people at all age levels about charades. Everyone gets to sort of make a fool of themselves. Everyone sort of gets into it over time, especially, you know, how teenagers are like at the beginning, they don't want to do anything, that they don't look cool. But then we found that round after round of playing charades, the kids were getting on their knees and they were making, you know, weird sounds, and it just was a blast. So I find it a great thing to do, a great family activity that that doesn't involve screens, that kind of puts everyone on the same level. Kids know things their parents don't know. They enjoy that. Parents know things their kids don't know. They enjoy that. And like you mentioned before, Gabe, it opens up all this discussion about people who we know that they don't and they know that we don't. It's just a great, fun game. We laughed so hard during it. The memories kind of like last forever. So if you can pull it off, if you can talk your kids into it, why not have a game of charades?
I love charades.
Me too. It's so much fun. Especially when someone gets Moby Dick. That's always the best one.
you play raunchy charades.
Yeah, when you're in yeah.
That's a book, that guys. That's not
we
raunchy.
Never played that one. I'm going to recommend a viral video. This is a video that popped up on my Twitter feed this week. And it's a video of like a 10, 11-year-old girl talking to her mom in the car. It clarified something for me about my own daughter, who is 6 and who recently has started talking in this sort of hammy, affected way, as though she's trying to be the kind of sarcastic, eye-rolling kid that she sees on Nickelodeon shows on TV. Do you know what I'm talking about? This kind
yes.
of stagey mannerism?
Yep.
So this girl in the video was talking to her mom about something that happened at school, about like she tried to flirt with a boy and he didn't really give her anything back. And she does it in the same hammy, affected way, but her timing is just great and she's really committed to it. And like it's a story that she's like sad about, that this boy doesn't like her, but she's really enjoying performing the story and she does it. It's so funny and her mom is laughing and like it made me see something in this kid and maybe also in my kid and in all kids. At the core of this hammy affected thing is a kind of very sincere pleasure at communicating and at being funny and at participating in grown-up discourse. And I don't know. It's a great video. It's really funny. You should check it out. I'll put it on our Facebook page and maybe it will also spark profound feelings in you, or maybe you will just enjoy the video. Rebecca, what do you recommend?
I recommend a magazine subscription for your family. If you don't subscribe to The Week, it is a serious news consumer might be tempted to look down on The Week, but I think that it is an excellent Reader's Digest style wrap-up of everything that's going on in the world and around the country. And the reason I say it makes a great family magazine is that there are these roundups of sort of top stories and top opinion of the week. And even like they have a cool real estate section that's like brick homes across America or homes in Boise. And there's a really fun crossword puzzle that is, you know, a really good level for a family with smart kids to do. It's not New York Times level, but it's not TV Guide level either. It's like smack in the middle of those two. And it's a really great way, I think, to, if your kids have questions about something that's going on in the news or if they want some context, you can point them to an article in The Week, which is typically a couple of paragraphs long. It's usually like an excerpt of you know, somebody else's article, or it's a wrap up sort of explaining reporting around things, or it just kind of gives you the rundown and background on topics, you know, things like, for instance, you know, Medicaid expansion. If that's something that you feel like your kids, if they have questions about like, why do people care about this whole ACA thing or whatever, there's probably something in this week's of The Week that would help explain it. And it's in our family a really great way to not only answer questions, but also it's nice to just have lying around. It's one of those magazines that everybody seems to pick up and look at some point, go to some section. I don't know. I didn't subscribe thinking it was going to be like a family thing. I think I got it as a gift, but I've continued to subscribe because everybody in the family at some point has their hands on it during the week. So that's my recommendation. Subscribe to The Week.
Great. All right. That's it from us. Thank you for being with us. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Rebecca Lavoie and Carvel Wallace. Thanks for being with us, guys.
Thank you so much for
having
me back.
Such a pleasure to be here all the time.
All right. Yeah. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, you can come visit us on our Facebook page. Tell us what you think. Facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Call and leave us a message at 424-255-7833. This week's episode of Mom and Dad Are Fighting was produced by Benjamin Frisch. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. The managing producer is June Thomas. Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. Slate's podcasting is part of the Panoply Network. You can find more Panoply shows at panoply.fm. We will see you in 2 weeks.